What up, listener? We wanted to take a second to thank you for listening to this Blue Wire podcast. Be sure to show your support to this pod by subscribing and dropping a 5-star review on iTunes, a follow on Spotify, or the appropriate dApp for any other platform you might be listening on. And if you're enjoying this show, chances are you'll like one of our 75 other sports podcasts. Find more shows you'll love at BlueWirePods.com. Thanks again for listening, and now back to your regularly scheduled podcast.
What it do, Hardwood Knox party people? I am Dan Favalli, coming at you without my co-host Andy Bailey this time, but it is one of your mailbag pods that we will be dropping more regularly, two, maybe three times a week. It depends upon what we're doing, but we will be pumping them out. As a result, we're going to continue to be shills for our own podcast. We are begging and pleading with you to continue rating, reviewing, subscribing to us on iTunes. You can also do the same wherever else you're getting your podcasts. Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, all those good places. If you want to be a superhero, though, go to iTunes anyway, even if you're listening to us elsewhere. Search Hardwood Knox, rate, review us. You can leave constructive criticism. We take it all to heart. Someone just wrote that we're unpolished. I'm not entirely sure what that means, but they said they enjoy us as well. So we appreciate it. We do prep work. We also like doing it off the cuff here. We apologize if it comes off as unpolished. That's just the nature of the biz. Not complaining. Again, we appreciate any and all feedback. Another thing you can do to help the podcast is follow us on YouTube. These mailbag podcasts will not be going up on YouTube unless there's a greater demand for them to be there, but our regular length episodes will be. YouTube.com, search Hardwood Knox, will pop up. Subscribe, like all our videos. Sometimes some special short video edits will be going up there that I make if I have the time. You'll enjoy it. You can also help the podcast by following the Blue Wire Network on Twitter, at Blue Wire Pods. I'm running the account. And any engagement we get there is going to help us a ton directly with the pod. You can follow me on Twitter if you'd like, if you dare, at Dan Favalli, F-A-V-A-L-E. You can follow Andy on Twitter at Andrew D. Bailey. The show, as always, is at Hardwood Knox. Last but certainly not least, we want to shout out today's sponsors who you'll be hearing from post-haste, basically, but shout out to Untuckit and betonline.ag. They're making this Hardwood Knox content possible, and we love them. We appreciate them. Use the promo codes that we're going to be dropping for you in a little bit. And in fact, it won't be a little bit, because it's time for our Bet Online AG segment this week. Fast Five. We are going to be breaking these out for betonline.ag. They're going to sponsor these segments, and as they do, we are going to give you this Fast Five, particularly when it's notable. And it's basically going to be me going through and reacting to five news items. It'll be Andy as well. Sometimes it'll be the two of us doing it together. BetOnline.ag is your online sportsbook expert. Use the promo code BLUEWIRE, all one word, for a 50% off welcome bonus. Again, that's BLUEWIRE, all one word. We want to thank them for sponsoring this Fast Five segment, which will be becoming a regular thing, so this intro will be more polished. But again, shout-outs to BetOnline.ag for sponsoring Fast Five. So let's start this Fast Five. I'm going to begin with what I think you need to know. The Toronto Raptors have won 14 straight games. Absolutely, positively absurd. They are beating quality teams. They beat the Pacers after Kyle Lowry left that game with an injury. They were able to win the very next night as well without him. They're dealing with Marc Gasol, who has a hamstring injury and has not played since January 28th. Norman Powell is out with a finger injury. They lost Kawhi. They lost Danny Green over the offseason. The fact that they are number two in the Eastern Conference, 39-14, still comfortably behind the Milwaukee Bucks, I don't know if people appreciate just how absurd that is. And a lot of people have been quick to point out that, yeah, they were good with Kawhi last year. And look, I get it, but you also lost Danny Green as a part of that. And I'm just going to go through some perspective about their lineups. If you go to their seventh most used lineup last season, one, Kawhi Leonard was in six of their seven most used lineups by possessions played per cleaning the glass last year. If you go to their seventh most used lineup, it was Kyle Lowry, Fred VanVleet, Kawhi Leonard, Pascal Siakam, and Serge Ibaka. If you do that this year, we are not done with the entire season, but again, this is just for perspective of what they're sort of dealing with. Their seventh most used lineup right now is Fred VanVleet, Norman Powell, Pascal Siakam, Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, and Marc Gasol. That's a big difference. And so there is a talent deficit compared to last year. And it's particularly when you look at the time that Siakam has missed, that Gasol has missed, I already said Pascal Siakam, Kyle Lowry has missed, excuse me, I'm stuttering through there. This is a big deal. And they're finding ways to win games. They are scrappy on defense. It's fun watching them. Fred VanVleet is going to get paid over the offseason. It's also important to note that Serge Ibaka shooting 10 of 17 in the clutch this year, including 3 of 5 from 3. Absolutely ridiculous. I thought it'd be a good idea. Let's check in with Victor Oladipo 5 games into his return. That is item number 2. The raw numbers do not look great. He has, through his 5 appearances, he's averaging 23.8 minutes per game, 10.6 points, 2.6 assists, 38.3 true shooting. The Pacers are getting absolutely trucked when he's on the floor. They have a minus 13.1 net rating per 100 possessions. When you watch him, though, of the two and a half games about that I've seen with him, and then trying to watch some tape before this podcast, it seems like he's moving really well defensively. And he's taking a ton more of his shots from three, more than half of them right now. That's certainly an adjustment. He's only shooting 21.2% from three at the moment. He's getting to the rim, not as often as he did last year, but more often than I thought he would coming back from this quad injury. He's at about, you know, 20% of his shots at the rim, 19% around there, compared to 22.6 last year. He has cut down a ton on his long twos. Like I said, more than half his shots are coming from three. It's something to monitor, but I think it's good to see that there have been moments where he's attacking. You know I'm going to like his shot profile, and I think he's talented enough to see more of those three balls certainly fall. And the fact that it just doesn't look like he's, at least particularly in that Toronto game through spurts, it just did not look like he was overmatched on the defensive end for these long stretches, and that might be the most important thing sort of coming back from this. Our third news item, we have to talk about the Blazers losing to the Jazz on Friday night. I did not see it live. I went to bed after the first half. I live on the East Coast. I make no apologies for that. Friday night's a night where I can try to get to bed, usually at a reasonable hour. Lillard, as we all know, hit what should have been a game-tying layup with 11.2 seconds remaining. There was a goaltend on Rudy Gobert. He hit it after it was off the glass, but it was never called, and they couldn't challenge it because it wasn't called. And Damian Lillard was pissed off afterwards. He had to be restrained after the game. He said, quote, this is per Yahoo Sports, we get to the last play of the game and they miss an easy call. And then they tell us that it's an easy no call. Like, that was obviously not a goaltend. It cost us a fucking game, man. He also said after the NBA released the report on Twitter that there should have been a goaltend called. He quote tweeted it with, we don't want to hear that shit. Clearly frustrated, has all the reason in the world to be. There might have also been a foul on Royce O'Neal there. I believe it was Royce O'Neal on the behind the play. Either way, it caused that missed call cost him a game tying layup. I go back and forth on it because I'm of the mind that there are 47 plus other minutes being played in the game, and so no outcome is truly determined by one call. At the same time, it's fair to criticize the refs because these are the moments when they need to get those calls right. And this is just a particularly weighty call, because, or no call, I should say, because the Blazers are fighting for a playoff spot. They're 3 losses behind the Memphis Grizzlies. If they win that game, and I'm not saying they necessarily would have, but if they win that game, they're only 2 losses behind the Memphis Grizzlies. That's something that could make a difference at the end of the year, and something that they'll keep coming back to. And Lillard, I think, justifiably livid after the game where he needed to be restrained by Director of Security official Rick Riley, I believe it was, when he was trying to approach the referee. And the fact that the referees described it as it wasn't even close to being a goaltend, that's really going to contribute to how angry he was. And so it's something to watch in the scheme of the Blazers playoff push. We also need to keep an eye on the Jazz, who have just not looked too great. And to see Portland was playing the second end of a back-to-back to almost maybe steal that game in Utah would have been absolutely huge for them. Just watching the replay, though, a clear goaltend, and the fact that it was a no-call there, it really is inexcusable. And Andy, the Jazz super fan of this podcast, I think he can agree to some extent. Maybe he'll be a little blinded by his fandom. We talked about it a little bit afterwards. It was a no-call. But again, there were 47 other minutes in the game. But the flip side to that, once more, is that's when the referees need to get these calls right, is inside that final minute, inside crunch time when so many things are happening. On a positive note, though, since the Blazers' 13-point loss to OKC on January 18th, which is a span of 9 games, Damian Lillard is averaging 42.4 points per game on 53% shooting from three, and he's taking 12.8 three-point attempts per game. He's been lights out in the clutch during that time, and he has a 69.5 true shooting just overall through that stretch. They are 6-3 over it, potentially could have been 7-2 if it wasn't for that no call. He's just been molten, volcanic. It's absolutely incredible to watch. The fourth thing we have on our list, Kevin Durant once again explained why he chose to sign with the Warriors in 2016. This was what he told Matt Barnes and Steven Jackson on All the Smoke podcast. Quote, in OKC, I played with a lot of athletes. I didn't play with a lot of skill guys, not like shooters and ball handlers. So after a while, my game started to grow and I was like, I need a change. This was before the 2015-2016 season even started. I was tired of being the only guy who could make threes, make jump shots, and consistently make them. Look, I could understand that frustration. And I think Kevin Durant, this is more, if you listen to it, that clip, this was just more of a conversation, so he wasn't exactly having to justify it to typical media members. He doesn't need to justify it anymore, though, in my opinion, and his story just seems like it keeps changing. He wanted to be a part of that bond, of the Hamptons Five going out there to get him. He left it just, it seems like his response changes every time, and I was going through just past articles of some of the reasons he gave, and there have been at least between 3 and 5 underlying reasons that he's said or used to justify leaving the Thunder, and they could all be true, but it's just funny that it seems like his story continues to change there, and I hope it at some point he can stop being asked about it and we can move past it. He won 2 rings while he was there. It didn't end in the cleanest of fashion, but that was a great team. It was his right to leave in free agency. I don't think it makes him any less of a basketball player, and the people who do, I really think it's out of control. Also, that definitely has to be shade at Russell Westbrook. It's just too pointed. I played with a lot of athletes. I didn't play with a lot of skill guys, not like shooters and ball handlers. So yeah, the final note we have here in the Fast Five, just want to note that Marvin Williams was bought out by the Hornets and signed with the Bucks. What a damn flex by Giannis Antetokounmpo. He's not the sole reason, but the fact that the Bucks get a guy like this when I think Marvin Williams could have helped the Clippers. Some people thought he could have helped the Lakers. I wasn't too high on that. The Rockets, I know they've been leaning into small ball. We'll talk about that in a second, but that would have been a team where he would have fit. Boston as well, reunite with Kemba Walker there. The fact that he goes to the Bucks, one, shows how dangerous they are. We're actually going to talk about them in a little bit. On pace for 71 victories, just absolutely absurd. But he's also a great fit there. And when they go smaller now, where if he's going to take up those Robin Lopez minutes, maybe even eat into a little bit of playing time with Brooke Lopez because you want Giannis to be up front where it's him and Marvin Williams, and maybe they just determine who's the five on a possession-by-possession basis, that could really work. And there's been, from the games that I've seen Williams in this year, it seems like there's been some slippage with his defensive mobility in the half court, but he's more switchable than when you look at him, then he just looks. And the fact that he can space the floor with the three ball, I think this is going to be a really good addition for the Bucks. I know these buyouts, they don't typically become these swing pieces, but I think there's a real chance that Marvin Williams can. That does it. There you have it. The betonline.ag Fast Five of the Week. Remember to use promo code BLUEWIRE, all one word, for your 50% welcome bonus at betonline.ag. Fast Five was fun. The movie too, but also just what we did. But now it's really time to get into some mailbag questions. Just as a brief refresher, we appreciate all your solicitations. We're going to try to get as many as we can throughout the week. And the goal is to probably go through between 7 and 10 per episode, because we don't want these to be super long episodes. I think Andy's first one was like 45 minutes, almost a regular length episode. We want them to be shorter than that. So we're just going to hop right into it today. Our first question comes from Caden, Twitter handle at echo18934741. How has Devin Booker's season compared to other similar guards this season and past seasons? So I didn't look specifically at guards for this question because I feel like it does Devin Booker a disservice, and I'm not someone who gets bogged down in positional designations anyway, even if it's just a matter of backcourt, frontcourt. But let's put this into context, strictly this season. Here are the players who are averaging, like Devin Booker, more than 25 points and 6 assists per 75 possessions with a true shooting percentage above 60. And again, this list is absolutely wild. Devin Booker, Damian Lillard, James Harden, and Giannis Antetokounmpo. That's it. Devin Booker has the highest true shooting percentage of that bunch at 63.1. That is an absolutely nutso true shooting percentage. And let's look at just his scoring. And when you just lower the threshold to 20 points per 75 possessions, there are 53 players that are clearing that many points per 75 possessions. Devin Booker is third in true shooting percentage with his 63.1 mark. The players in front of him, Jonas Valanciunas and Christian Wood. So he has the highest true shooting percentage among non-bigs, averaging at least 20 points per 100 possessions. And that's a huge sample that we're looking at. It's, you know, if we're looking at just wings or non-bigs, yes, that'll diminish. But the fact that he's third in this 53-player sample is absolutely wild. And he's having a fantastic season. In terms of how it compares historically, I'm not a super fan of doing these types of exercises anymore. I really used to be, but just given how many threes are shot, it's even going for the per-possession stats. It can be skewed a little bit, but I do think it's interesting to see, well, then what current players have ever sort of matched this throughout history. So take this with the grain of salt that it is, where a guy like, just use Michael Jordan as an example. Like, he didn't play the brand of basketball that's being played right now, and I know Devin Booker isn't exactly chucking threes like crazy either, so maybe that's a reason to get it, to be more impressed with this. But here we go. Here's everyone who has matched Devin Booker's points, 26.3, and assists, 6.2, per 75 possessions with a true shooting percentage of 63 or higher. So there, anyone that's matched Devin Booker's splits per 75 possessions or better throughout NBA history. Stephen Curry, twice. LeBron James, twice. And Giannis Antetokounmpo did it last season. And the most, the as far back as this goes, yes, it's a search throughout 1973 and on. LeBron James is the earliest player to have done it, 2012, 2013. He did it again in 13, 14. Steph did it in 14-15, and then in 15-16. Giannis did it last season, and now Devin Booker's doing it now. He's just having an absolutely mind-melting season. When we talk about all-star snubs, sometimes it's difficult because you need to be able to name someone who's coming off. He's absolutely an all-star snub, and he should have been named. I would have put him in over Russell Westbrook. He definitely had a case over Donovan Mitchell as well, but I think Westbrook is the spot that really threw me for a whirl looking at that. Our next question comes from Frederick Brandt at Fred the Pet. His question, do you believe Trae Young is the worst defender in the NBA? Statistically, he basically is. He ranks 499th out of 500 players in luck-adjusted, defensive, real-adjusted, plus-minus. So L-A-D-A-R-P-M. That's terrible. Miles Bridges is dead last for anyone who cares. Trae Young, he's not long. He's not super strong. He does need to try to provide more resistance in the half court. I'm wondering if having Capella behind him might make the Hawks' defensive splits a little bit better. But he could be right up there. He's also playing a position where even if you're a great defender, you're still, if you're on the opposing team's point guard, which ideally, you're not going to see him on a ton, but if you're going up against backcourt players or guys who can handle the ball or guys who can attack mismatches because of your size, you're just at a huge disadvantage there. I'm not complimenting his defense, but it's so hard to say whether he's definitively the worst defender in the NBA, but if we were to just use maybe tiers, he's definitely one of the 10 worst. I would almost want to expand it for most players because I don't believe Miles Bridges is the worst defender in the NBA. I don't believe he's one of the 25 worst defenders in the NBA. But for Trae Young, I think you could comfortably say that he's one of the 10 worst defenders in the NBA. Next question comes from Gonzo, and the reason we actually didn't address it in the Fast Five with Marvin Williams and Darren Collison is because I had this question. His handle for Gonzo, at Mr. Gonzo M, is Michael Kidd-Gilchrist a good fit for the Dallas Mavericks? MKG was brokering a buyout with the Charlotte Hornets, and the Mavericks are his rumored top suitor as I'm recording this. I struggle to see whether he's a great fit. He's a zero on offense at this point, and never mind the shooting. It's just he doesn't give you, over the past couple of seasons, doesn't give you much in transition, hasn't been this spectacular your spectacular cutter. Maybe you can do things where you use him as the role man if you get super weird, but then you need to surround him by a ton of shooters. He's never shown great acumen as a passer, and so will he make quick passes to the corner on the roll? I honestly don't know. And the fact that he can't pop, it really makes sending him as the screener in pick and rolls maybe a little bit pointless. That said, he can be a good defender. The Mavs are bleeding points around the bucket. Since January 1st, they're 28th in opponent field goal percentage at the rim. They do have a top three three-point defense during that time, and that's really been basically the story of their whole season, is that they've had, whether it's luck or not, or they've been just good, their three-point defense statistically has been pretty darn good. And just on the inside, they're more vulnerable. Kristaps Porzingis has missed a ton of time, and he can also be overpowered at points. It certainly doesn't help that they don't have Dwight Powell anymore, but neither him or Maxi Kleber are the strongest guys. You look at Willie Cauley-Stein now. He's not some intuitive defender at all, really. So Michael K. Gilchrist, I could see him maybe guarding the bigger wings, and he's someone who you could stick on bigger guys, at least in the post. His post defense has been okay the past few seasons, so you could try it. And just to have another guy who can begin to try and cover the bigger wings in basketball, you're not going to slow Kawhi Leonard or LeBron James to a halt. But just to sort of muck them up a little bit, or have another body other than Dorian Finney-Smith that you feel good about putting on them, I think it's fine to make an addition like that. Our next question is going to come from Twitter user 2017 Russell Westbrook. I respect it, not going to lie. I'm actually not sure if this is a troll question, but I'm going to answer it anyway. Twitter handle at Kung Fu Cammy. What are Steph's isolation stats from the 2016 finals? Now, I don't have access to this data. I will say that for the 2016 season, Steph scored 1.08 points per isolation possession. Just for context, the Charlotte Hornets were ninth in offensive rating that year, and they averaged just under 1.08 points per possession. And so having Stephen Curry go in isolation that year was the equivalent of a comfortably top 10 offense, which is absolutely nuts. I do also remain of the mind that this narrative, this spin that Stephen Curry was terrible in the 2016 finals is not true. He shot 40% from three over those seven games, averaged 22.6 points, 3.7 assists. He didn't shoot his highest clip on two-pointers. He still shot 93% from the line. He did have bad games, you could say, that came at inopportune times. You look at game five, where he goes 8 of 21 from the field and 5 of 15 from three. That was the game Draymond Green missed. But the fact that he came back, shoots 6 of 13 from three the next game, and then, yes, he's 4 of 14 from three, including some really big misses down the stretch, 6 of 19 overall. He's been better, but Stephen Curry was not the sole reason the Warriors lost that series. And I feel like maybe people are reading too much into his opening game, but the fact that he can shoot the three ball the way he did, even when his shot overall, if it's a 4-15 night like it was in game one, that you could have counted on him to go 3 of 8 from three in that night, I just feel like we need to get away from this. You want to make jokes, I'm totally here for it. I'm here for jokes that troll, that aren't really speaking false truths. They're just mocking the mockery, essentially. But I don't buy into this belief that Stephen Curry was absolutely terrible during the 2016 NBA Finals. Our next question is about Nikola Jokic, because I feel like we have to answer one question about Nikola Jokic per episode, but also because Andy, who solicits these questions, has a lot of Jazz and Nuggets followers. So I try to mix it up. We got plenty of responses. But this, I found this Jokic question fascinating. It's from Ray Martinelli, handle at RxMart2. Is Jokic a top five player? Now, in a regular season, a normal season, we are in the regular season, my gut would say no, but that he's super close and might even be that top five player. I would put KD and Steph ahead of him if they were healthy, but they're not. So this year, let's look at it this year. There's LeBron, Giannis, and Kawhi as the players that I would have definitively in front of him. And again, we're looking at just this year. James Harden's slump, I really think, can hurt him in this conversation, but I would probably put him ahead of Jokic as well. So that's four. You have to consider Anthony Davis in this. You could probably give Joel Embiid some love after that. Damian Lillard, specifically this year, I think has a case. Jokic's, to me, is probably stronger then all of theirs, those other four alternatives after Harden, so the AD, Joel Embiid, Damian Lillard, the other three alternatives, excuse me, I'm not him and AD might be close, but the fact that the Lakers have been so bad when Anthony Davis plays without LeBron James on the floor, I do think that's something to consider, especially because, you know, we're not talking about a point guard versus a big. This is big versus big. And so what Jokic can do can more effectively anchor an offense when he's running solo or as the focal point than it can with Anthony Davis. I'm going to turn this into, though, the conversation about Jokic's MVP eligibility. I do think right now I'd probably have him in the top five. I don't know if he definitely wouldn't be in my top two. That would belong to Giannis and LeBron James. I don't know if James Harden's played poorly enough for long enough to fall off that third spot. You have Luka Doncic could be right there. Damian Lillard belongs in there as well. I think ultimately Jokic belongs in the top five. But his case was gaining some steam a few days ago because the Nuggets, they've been battling some injuries. They've been finding ways to win games anyway. And he's been spectacular. And he really has. Since Denver's 37-point win against the New York Knicks on December 5th, in which Nikola Jokic didn't really do, he played 30 minutes, but he didn't really do much. So that's why I'm using that as sort of the separation. He's played 34 games, averaging 23.8 points, 10.4 rebounds, 7.1 assists, 1.1 steals, slashing 54.6, 38.2, and then 81.4 from the foul line. That's great. What I have trouble overlooking is that he was not at this level or really anywhere close to it for almost a quarter of the season. So before that stretch through December 5th, a span of 19 games, which is very close to a quarter of the season, Jokic was averaging 14.9 points, 10.1 rebounds, 6.2 assists, 1.2 steals, slashing 45.1, 22.2% shooting from deep, and 77.6% from the foul line. He also wasn't getting to the foul line very often during that stretch. Wire-to-wire stuff matters, and that's why I don't think there's even a case for anyone other than Giannis Antetokounmpo or LeBron James right now. I just have those as the top two guys. James Harden was there, Luka Doncic was there, but then you have the injury to Doncic, and the Mavs have fallen off a little bit, also because of the injury to Porzingis, I'm sure, factors into that as well. And so you look at that, just more, they've been great, both Harden and Doncic, for most of the season, but you have to, I'm looking at wire to wire. This is a full season award, and Jokic has not been the most valuable player in basketball for the entire season. It's just that simple to me. Do I think he belongs in the peripheral discussion behind James, but behind Giannis Antetokounmpo? Absolutely. Do I think that he could maybe surpass Harden or Doncic in that conversation? Is he maybe already there? Is he going to finish higher than Dame? I think that's all possible and worth considering. He's not in the same tier as LeBron James and Giannis Antetokounmpo for me. And I'm not even sure LeBron is in Giannis's tier for me right now, too, because he's just been so dominant in so few minutes. It's unlike anything we've ever really seen. So Giannis is my MVP, but shouts to Nikola Jokic, I guess, for playing well. I guess. That's a real shout. Ever see an untucked button-down? They look bad. Why? Because they weren't meant to be worn that way. Thankfully, there's Untuck It, the original button-down shirt actually designed to be worn untucked. No matter your size or shape, untucked shirts always fall at the perfect untucked length. With more than 50-plus fit combinations, untucked shirts look great on tall, short, slim, and athletic guys of all ages. You can find your favorite untucked style online or check out one of their 80 brick-and-mortar stores. Choose from styles like wrinkle-free button-downs, super soft flannels, outerwear, and more. With untucked, your shirts will never look baggy, bulgy, too long, or too big again. And their website is so easy to use, they even have a whole page devoted to helping you find your fit. So whether you're shopping for the perfect holiday gift or just trying to craft a smart, relaxed style of your own, Untuckit is the way to go. Visit untuckit.com and use promo code BLUE for 20% off at checkout. That's untuckit.com and promo code BLUE for 20% off. Our next question comes from Jay Khan at Jay Khan WI. Why is there so much blind faith with the Clippers as contenders, but so much doubt with the Bucks as contenders after what we've seen in the regular season so far? And is Kawhi enough to warrant that discrepancy? So let me tackle the first part first. The benefit of the doubt is more so given to the Clippers because Kawhi Leonard is a two-time NBA champion, two-time finals MVP, and the Clippers really haven't been at full strength ever this season, and they've straight Rick rolled opponents when Kawhi and Paul George play together. They have their issues. They could use another center, but now the fact that they've gotten Marcus Morris in there, that really just adds another depth dynamic, another body they could throw at bigger wings. He's been shooting the hell out of the ball from three. If he transitions into a lower on-ball volume role where he can subsist on those catch-and-shoot looks and continue to hit 46% on spot-up threes, they're going to be sitting pretty. What I kind of disagree with is that and I'll explain why there might be some doubt in the Bucks first, then. It's because we saw them kind of flame out later in the playoffs last year. Eric Bledsoe has not been good the past two postseasons. Everyone's going to talk about, is Chris Middleton a real number two? I think that's an unfair question. I actually think that he's closer to a viable championship number two than not, and that's probably not talked about enough. I don't know if the Bucks have inoculated themselves against a similar decline when you look at what could happen to their half-court offense this postseason, but I do think that they've come close organically, because I'm going to be of the mind that they should have paid the tax and kept Malcolm Brogdon, and that would be that, or that maybe they should have made a smaller move at the trade deadline with that Indiana pick. Could they have gotten in the Marcus Morris conversation, or was New York willing not to create the necessary roster spot since it would have effectively had to have been a 3-for-1? Whatever the case, I don't think we've talked enough about how Middleton is been closer to a top 25 player than a top 40 player. Closer to a top 25 player than a top 35 player this year. He might even be a top 25 player this year, and I'm not trying to be facetious. It's the fact that he's averaging essentially under 30 minutes a game, and so that's, I'm not going to penalize him for the Bucks being so dominant. Some other things I look at, Eric Bledsoe has been better offensively than he has been over the past couple seasons. I don't know if that's reliable, but he's actually been scoring fairly well in the limited isolation opportunities he's had. I think that's a huge plus. The other thing is that the Giannis at center lineups have been absolutely destroying opponents this year. And in years past, there have been some good returns, some bad returns. This time, though, it's like a volume lineup. He's already set a career high for the number of possessions he's logged at center. And that was before the halfway mark of the season, comfortably before the halfway mark of the season. The fact that they've been so dominant in those minutes, and now you add Marvin Williams to that, to where it makes it easier for you to go small without really losing, I guess, size or girth. Maybe there's still going to be issues there. Marvin Williams is 6'9". He's not, a real center, but to have him and Giannis be interchangeable there, maybe you can throw him on a Pascal Siakam so you don't have to put Antetokounmpo there. I don't know how well that works. I'm just saying it's more optionality. And so for the second part of this question, is Kawhi enough to warrant the discrepancy between the Clippers getting the benefit of the doubt and the Bucks not? It's absolutely not, because the Bucks are on pace to win 71 games this year. They are heavy favorites to come out of the Eastern Conference, as they should be. And I think there's a legitimate conversation to be had about, should they be the overall championship favorites? As of right now, I'm going to stick to my stubborn offseason pick of the Nuggets. I don't feel too great about it, but I'm a man of principle, even when it means being wrong. And I will change my mind if we come to the playoffs and I don't think the Nuggets are going to beat a team in the series. I don't have confidence in this pick now, but I kind of think that the Bucks have a better chance of winning the title than the Lakers, or even the Clippers right now. I lean towards that, but they all feel like they're on this three-team even plane, and that it's those three and then everyone else. And that's a hell of an accomplishment for the Bucks. It shouldn't be an insult, but I don't think it should be, oh, the Clippers are definitely better suited to win the title because they have Kawhi. You know what? Let's see Paul George stay healthy this year for an extended period of time. Let's see them shoot well from three again before we're ready to say this. So the Bucks have been fantastic, and I don't know if there's an issue of them not being talked enough. I'm not going to get into the Giannis contract, future free agency stuff, blah, 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 blah. The Bucks are dominant. They are one of the three title favorites in my book, and they can be the absolute title favorite. If you want to say that, I won't push back on it. Our next question, interesting question. I appreciated this one from Nick. At NPinto628, I asked this last time as well. Way to go, Andy, for missing a question. Is Mo Bamba quietly good now? Plus 1.3 Raptor, a somewhat lackluster plus 0.49 PIPM, but a plus 2.40 defensive PIPM, both of which are big improvements over last year. His defensive field goal percentage on shots inside of 6 feet is 48.7, best among bigs from the 2018 draft class. Mo Bamba, I would say, is quietly solid now. If you look at the players who are holding opponents to under 50% shooting at the rim on at least four challenged shots in that area per game, you get five names: JaVale McGee, Zach Collins, Avicii Zubac, and Brook Lopez, plus Mo Bamba. that's pretty good company to be in. Zach Collins has only played in three games, so it's really only four players, Bamba, McGee, Zubats, and Lopez. Lopez is known as one of the premier rim protectors in the game. Ironically, remove Collins from the equation, and he has the lowest defensive field goal percentage in those situations. Not a perfect measurement, but let's look at if Bamba is actually impacting the shots that are being taken when he's on the court. The Magic's opponents are getting to the rim more frequently when he's on the floor. That could have a ton to do with the fact that he's playing just with the second unit heavy combinations in general. But when he's on the floor, opponents are shooting 6.8 percentage points worse at the rim than their season average. That's the 98th percentile, which is absolutely wild. Some of the other catch-all metrics are mixed, though. If you look at luck-adjusted, defensive real adjusted plus minus, he's in the top 100. He's 96. That's not super spectacular, but it's also in the top, 80% of the league if we're going by the full 500 players that qualified for it. So that's not terrible either. Where I worry about him is, can he be more on offense? He's taking 72% of his shots at the rim or beyond the arc. He needs to hit all those looks more consistently. Is he going to be able to be a consistent roller to the basket when he's not particularly strong? It could be tough in Orlando's system where they just don't have a ton of floor spacers around him. He doesn't shoot threes in a ton of volume. He's just not taking shots in general in a ton of volume. He's 33.3% from three for the season. However, he's at 54.5% from deep over his last eight games, under two attempts per game, but he's also not playing an exceptional amount of minutes. I'm here to say that Mo Bamba is an NBA player. I think that he right now can be considered a fringe starting center, but there could be concerns defensively if you're going up against stronger fives, and there needs to be more of an offensive contribution just consistently. I don't know if that's a matter of the Magic changing up his personnel or maybe he looks better on another team, but the fact that he can move so well on the defensive end overall, and that's already the impact is already showing up when he's not starting with this team. That's important because the Magic bench isn't setting the world on fire. And so kudos to him. And yes, that is an underrated storyline. Also just underrated in general is that the Magic have absolutely gotten to the point where maybe we don't need to worry about them missing the playoffs. Do you trust the Wizards? They are one game in front of the Wizards in the loss column, but they have four more wins, 22-31 versus 18-32. Then there's the Bulls, Pistons, and Knicks. I guess Washington's their biggest threat, although the Knicks recently went on a winning streak, so that's something to note. The Magic have been just up and down. It seems like they put it together, but now as we're recording this, they've lost three in a row. That's something to monitor, is can the Wizards catch them, or will Detroit's not coming out of left field after trading Andre Drummond? I really don't think so. Can Chicago do it? They're dealing with so many injuries. The Knicks, the Leon Rose era, everybody, maybe, probably not. So it does feel like the Magic, even though the record doesn't reflect it, even though their consistency overall doesn't reflect it, and they are dealing with injuries themselves, they've really sewn up a playoff spot right now. That's how it looks to me. I'm going to make this our final question because the episode's already been a little too long for the type of pace that we're going for. It comes from Ryan at Ryan News Private. Thoughts on the Rockets' small ball lineup? Counter question, which one? Really just kidding. I'm an asshole. I know that. So if you look, Covington and Tucker have played 75 possessions together already, with PJ Tucker being the de facto center in those situations. In 75 possessions, Houston's net rating is plus 18.7. They have a defensive rating in the 99th percentile with an offensive rating in the 94th percentile. The things that they've done well during that stretch, it's just I don't think it's going to hold because they've been getting killed on the glass overall. In Tucker's minutes, I do think someone like Covington, a good team defender, takes too many risks, but he doesn't necessarily foul a ton when he's doing those, and so that will help Houston keep their fouls under control when they're going small, which is tough, which is actually a good thing. It's tough, I should say, because you're going against these just bigger, brutal players that can really force you into some awkward situations, and maybe he helps there. I don't think he's going to help their rebounding to the extent where they have a defensive rebounding rate in the 90th percentile. Such a small sample, so I'm going to say this about the overarching discussion. I don't know if it could work, and having a Marvin Williams type on their team feels like it would have been great just to have that, not super tall body, but bigger body that you can say, well, he would normally be a small ball five where Tucker wouldn't. that certainly helps. We'll just have to see. I think it will pay off in the regular season, and I respect them leaning into it if that's how they want to play. You can quibble over whether they should have treated Rocco as the best player in a Clint Capela deal to the extent that they gave up a first-round pick in that trade while ducking the tax as well, and then they were able to use Jordan Bell and a second-round pick swap to get Bruno Caboclo. We'll have to see when he's healthy, if he's going to get some small ball 5 minutes for them. There's a lot to digest there, but I respect what Daryl Morey, head coach Mike D'Antoni, just the Rockets organization, minus Tillman Fertitta's obsession with ducking attacks, are doing. Because if this is how you want to play, do it. And they kind of have to play this way. They're not so much rejiggering the roster around James Harden as they are catering to Russell Westbrook. They don't believe they can have two non-shooters on the floor, and with Capella and Westbrook, they have two non-shooters. And so Westbrook with small ball is going to have more open lanes to the basket. You just watch a game, hit pause, and just look at the spacing on this. There's no one in the paint because they're going to have four shooters on the court at all times around Russell Westbrook, and you can't give him too much room because he still has that speed to get by you. And so I really like what the Rockets have done. We'll see if it works in due time. That's going to do it for this episode. We'll make the closings short and sweet. Thank you all for listening. We hope you're enjoying these mailbags pods as much as we're enjoying doing them. Follow Hardwood Knocks on Twitter. Rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, all that great stuff. Until next time, I'm going to leave you with a shout-out to Kyle Anderson and absolutely nobody else.